Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
He goes, "Who's the Batman?" I said, "The only thing I could say to him was, I can't help you. I can't help you. I can't say I don't know. That's a lie. But I can't help you." He goes, oh, you can't help me, huh? And he opens his desk drawer and he pulls out this piece of paper and he throws it on his desk. And it's a letter to Stephen Batman Peterson, my protector, from Kelly Morgan. Thank you so much. And stapled to it is a Polaroid picture of me and Kelly. And I got the suit on.
Oh, thank God you didn't laugh.
So he looks at me and he goes, "Well?" And I said, "I am Batman."
Hey, gang, welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is Steve Peterson, retired DEA special agent, 30 years experience, extremely talented and experienced law enforcement instructor, undercover agent. If you joined us yesterday, if you didn't, go back and listen to it, please, because we talk about the death of a DEA agent, a hero who sacrificed his life protecting us. We had a lot of fun yesterday, but we also got serious there towards the end. But one of the things that we talked about yesterday was Steve is also known as the Batman of DEA. And if you didn't listen to yesterday, you're like, "What the hell is that?" Well, go listen to it. But you heard it. I'm sure you did listen yesterday. And he talked about how he might show up on a raid or an operation. And Batman just would remarkably show up with the headpiece and the cape and a lot of funny stories to go along with that. But Steve, welcome back to Game of Crimes, by the way, brother.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me back, Murph. I really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun yesterday.
Oh, a lot of tears rolled down my cheeks here from laughter. But now you went to one raid about Batman, and was there, I think, so Steve is writing a book. It's ready. It has not been printed yet. They are taking pre-orders on his book. The name of it is The Batman of DEA. Crime-fighting adventures of a street agent. And what I'm looking at over here is Amazon. So you can pre-order this on Amazon at Barnes & Noble. I mean, there's a ton of bookstores where you can pre-order it. If you want some really funny police stories, this is the book you want to take a look at. I'm telling you, he sent me the draft script maybe a year ago or 6 months ago. And I learned so much. I've known this guy for a long time, but I learned so much about him that I didn't know. But it is just hilarious. But you were out on a raid, and a TV crew, I think, was there, and happened to – did they film Batman showing up or what?
Well, it's kind of a – all right, here's the story. We talked yesterday about how powerful and important DEA SACs are, SAC, Special Agent in Charge. Well, Atlanta got a new one, and this was back in 89. Back in 89, shortly after – I got the suit. Not long after I got the suit, got a new SAC, and he just loved being in the media. He is very jealous of the FBI. Hated the FBI because they got all the media attention, and he wanted it. So he agreed with NBC News to do the equivalent of a cops episode, like a cops show about DEA, and it was called Operation Stakeout. Now, if you've ever seen Cops, the camera crew that goes out and films these cops shows, they're with these guys for like weeks, so they can get 30 minutes of usable footage. Well, we staged everything, so we don't have to worry. You know, we filmed it all in like 3 days. And so we're doing this stuff, and one of the scenarios, was that we were going to go to North Georgia and use this airstrip up there, like a county airstrip, and a town called Dahlonega, which apparently is the carpet capital of the world. All the carpet in the United States is made in like, Dalton, Georgia. Yeah. Get all my D's mixed up. And so we go up to Dalton, and the scenario is we're going to show the camera crew how we would interdict a smuggler's plane full of dope. right? Full of drugs and using planes and cars and stuff. And shortly before I got to Atlanta, shortly before I arrived there, DEA Atlanta had actually locked up two different sheriffs who from Georgia who worked in counties along the Florida border. And they were like shutting down these rural roads in the backwoods of their counties to let Colombian cartel dope plane fly in. And they both these two sheriffs, totally unrelated, both got arrested. So this was not like something out of the ordinary. This is just what happened a few years previous. So anyways, so we have to drive up there in our cars, and then DEA is going to use a couple of DEA planes. One will be the bad guy plane and a couple of good guys. And they bring up the camera crew, and NBC News was filming all this. And they were using as the host a woman named Kelly Morgan. And Kelly Morgan was this blonde, when she may still be, blonde baby doll, absolute drop-dead gorgeous woman. She was the anchor woman, I think, for the NBC local affiliate in Atlanta for their 11 o'clock news, I think. And so she was going to be the host of the show and put it on. So she came to all the little scenarios. So we get up to Dalton. We're waiting for the planes to come, and they're not coming, and they're late. And of course, we're all sitting up there waiting, getting bored as can be. Well, nothing more dangerous than a bored cop. So I remember the planes landing, and Kelly gets out of one of the planes. And I remember this as if it were yesterday. She gets out of the plane. She's wearing a sleeveless maroon down vest. And she gets out, and she takes that blonde hair, and I just melted. I was like, I'm in love with Kelly Morgan. And she's in love with me, but she doesn't know it yet because she hadn't met me. And I'm just like, how do I get this woman's attention? I put on the suit. Right. So while they're setting up all this crap, I run out.
What could go wrong?
Yeah. God, nothing. I didn't really see that far ahead. And so I go and put on, it takes a little bit because it's all rubber spandex and it doesn't go on easy. So I'm putting on all this crap. And we get down to film, and they were like, where'd Peterson go? Where is he? He's supposed to be out here. And so I come walking around the building, and I got the suit on. And that's the first time most of the DEA guys had ever seen me in a suit. When I wore it out to do raids, I did it with local PD. I wouldn't do a DEA because they'd call the boss on me and stuff. I don't want that happening. So anyways, we had a big laugh. We told some story. We had some fun, made some fun out of it. Then I got to go back and take it all off so we can film this episode or whatever, this event. So about a week or two later, it comes on the local NBC affiliate in Atlanta. Operation Stakeout, hosted by Kelly Morgan. And I'm sitting at home on a sofa next to my ex, and they're going through it, and they blacked out all our faces and stuff. So I have to, you know, this Bill and this Terry, it is me, you know, whatever. I'm kind of narrating to her what's happening during each of these little scenarios. And at the end, at the very end, Kelly Morgan says, I want to thank the SAC for all his support, blah, blah, blah. But we want to say a very special thank you to a crime-fighting guest star. And they go to this clip that's maybe a second long. That's how quick it is. It's me, with the suit on, walking around the corner of the building where I went and took it off. I didn't know that they filmed that. And so they put that on there, but it's clear as a bell. It's the ears, the cape. I mean, it's freaking Batman. There's no denying that. And my ex-wife, she starts laughing. She's like, hey, look, you're on TV. I was like, that ain't funny. When did they get it? Holy crap. So the next morning, I go into the office, and sitting at my desk is the SAC's secretary. And I said, hey, Donna, what are you doing back here? You slumming it? What's going on? Why are you here? She goes, I'm waiting for you. The SAC wants to see you in his office right away. And I was like, oh God, this is not good. I said, I don't even think he knows who I am. He's only been here a few. She goes, he knows exactly who you are. And so I'm following her like a little puppy. And I'm like, well, did he seem mad? What did he say? She won't tell me nothing. So we walk up to the front office and his door is open. I go up there and I knock on his door. I said, hey boss, I'm Steve Peterson. I heard you want to see me. And she goes, he goes, I know who you are. Get in here. I don't like the tone on this one. So I step in. I say, yes, sir, what can I do for you? He goes, you want to explain to me what the hell I saw on television last night? I said, well, boss, no disrespect, but I don't know what you watch. which was really kind of a stupid answer. And he goes, what the hell's Batman doing on the damn news? I said, oh, that. I said, I was there for all these scenarios that they filmed. And I got to be honest with you, I never saw Batman. So I don't know where that footage came from. I don't know where they got that. I have no idea. He goes, ever since I've been here, I've been hearing stories about the Batman. And I want to know, who is the Batman? And you know, from your experience with DEA, you get in trouble, you do stupid stuff. But you lie, you get fired for it. All right? That's a Giglio offense. I'm getting jammed up. So I can't lie. So he goes, who's the Batman? I said, the only thing I could say to him was, I can't help you. I can't help you. I can't say I don't know. That's a lie. I can't help you. He goes, oh, you can't help me, huh? And he opens his desk drawer and he pulls out this piece of paper and he throws it on his desk. And it's a letter to Stephen Batman Peterson, my protector, from Kelly Morgan. Thank you so much. And stapled to it is a Polaroid picture of me and Kelly. And I got the suit on.
Oh, thank God you didn't lie.
So he looks at me and he goes, well? And I said, I am Batman. And the next day I got transferred to Charlotte. I got kicked out of the city of Atlanta.
That quick.
I'll tell you, I was pissed. I was not happy. The ASAC, the assistant special agent in charge, who at the time was seated in Atlanta, his area of responsibility was North Carolina. And he hated me. We got into it a couple times over the Stastny death. And he hated me. And when I came walking out of the office with my head hung low out of the SAC's office right after that little fiasco, he started laughing. He's like, well, Batman, I'll be watching your ass up in North Carolina. And I was like, oh, my God, this is going to be horrible. Horrible. But he got jammed up worse, and he got transferred out before I reported to North Carolina. So it all worked out. In the end, it was the best thing that could have happened to me in the end, but not at the time.
Did you ever think that or realize that somewhere down the road, you're going to become a DEA legend because of your Batman suit?
What's so funny, Murph, I had been retired like 2 years, and I get a phone call, right, on my cell phone from some guy. Hey, my name's Steve Murphy, and I'm with OPR, the DEA headquarters, our internal affairs people. And he goes, and our records show that you've stolen a laptop. And I'm like, what? What are you talking about? He goes, you had a laptop assigned to you, and this is a serial number. Like I would remember the serial number. Oh, I don't know the serial number of my computer I'm using right now. And he goes, and you never turned it in, and you left. And never. I said, whoa, Spanky. I said, I've got a receipt for that. Because I knew this would happen. So I said, I've got a receipt where I turn that over to agent so-and-so when I retired. I've got a receipt. You have a I said, yes. Can you send us that copy of that receipt? I said, yeah. Send me an email, and I'll hit reply, and I'll send you the receipt. He goes, all right, what's your email address? batmanofdea@gmail.com. He goes, are you the Batman? And I said, depends. And he goes, you the guy who got kicked out of Atlanta for wearing a suit? And I started laughing. And I was like, yeah, that's me. And I can hear him. He like covers up the phone and yells to his buddies wherever and goes, hey, I got the real Batman on the phone. This guy's real. And I had to burst out laughing. He goes, dude, you're like a myth up here. Nobody believes it, but we've all heard these stories. I said, well, I'm not sure it's good that Internal Affairs knows who you are. I said, but what are they going to do, hire me back so they can fire me? I thought that was funny.
Yeah, it is. It is. Thank goodness we keep receipts because we know things can go sideways.
Yeah. Thank God I had a receipt for that.
When I left DEA, you know, between running the Met team in Atlanta for 2.5 years, and we had all kinds of equipment, I still got all my receipts, and I've been retired for 13 years.
Yep, and it'll come back and bite you on year 14 because you deleted them 13 years later.
Hey, well, let me ask you a question about another case that you were involved with in Atlanta. I think the defendant's name was Daryl Smith, but he's kind of referred to as the real-life Breaking Bad character.
I refer to him as that. DEA refuses to acknowledge that. Because they don't want to have to pay any kind of royalties or anything. They won't acknowledge it. But when Breaking Bad came out, I was still on a job. And I didn't watch any of it because I didn't believe in heroicizing, if that's even a word, criminals. I don't want to, you know, that's just not where I come from. So I didn't watch any of that until I retired. And then when I retired, I don't remember, I guess I was still in Charlotte at the time. My wife and I watched the entire five seasons, whatever, over a period of like 2 months. And we were, because we were like, damn. And as I'm watching this, I was at home going,
I know that guy.
Some of the things changed. Breaking Bad, Walter's a chemistry teacher who gets cancer, and right? But in reality, Daryl is a doctor, but he never practiced medicine. He only made dope for the bikers, the gang of the Outlaws, the second largest motorcycle gang in the country. Right? Hell's Angels is the first, Outlaws the second. And so he made millions of dollars making meth for the Outlaws. And we came across this case when I was still in it, when I got pulled, when Ray and I broke up originally, Ray Stassi and I, when they broke us up as partners, I got assigned to DEA SEO 383, which was DEA's designation for our storefront. I don't know what the other 382 were, or whatever. I don't know what those things were, but 383 was the storefront in Atlanta. We had an actual store in a strip shopping mall or shopping plaza that was disguised as a regular retail business where we sold chemicals and equipment to criminals or anybody who walked in. But if you were a Joe Citizen walking in wanting to buy something for, I don't know, your home brewery or whatever, we would just treat you like dirt and charge you 10 times more money and you'd leave on your own because you don't want nothing to do with us. But we would advertise in different biker magazines and stuff because the internet didn't exist, so we couldn't enter. And every couple of years, we'd change our name and move to a new shopping plaza. So because people, once the bad guys know who you are, you're useless. And one day, Daryl came in and bought some equipment from us. And so we saw what he drove. We saw who he was. He acted squirrely, and then we would network with all the large chemical companies and so forth in the metro Atlanta area. And one of our liaison contacts from this big chemical company called us and said, this guy named Daryl Smith just ordered 15 55-gallon drums of ether. We call that a clue.
Yes.
Yeah. So we were like, damn. So long story short, we followed him. He brought him to a mini warehouse. He dropped them all off. We set up cameras. We followed this guy for probably a year and a half, maybe close to 2 years. And at one point, I was following his wife because his wife was a model from England. He posed himself off as being a professional poker player. And he would often go to a trophy shop and buy his own trophies, showing that he had won the, I don't know, the mega supertron of poker or whatever. These things didn't even exist, these tournaments. And that's how he explained to all his neighbors where his cash, where all his money came from. He wanted to play poker. And he had a whole curio cabinet of fake trophies. And anyway, so I was following his wife one day, and his wife ran a nail salon. They were laundering money through the nail salon. So I would go up to the nail salon every so often, and I would watch his wife, who was very cute, but I would count the number of people, customers that would come and go in the nail salon, and then we would subpoena their bank records periodically, and I would look at how much money did they take in that day? How much money did they deposit in the accounts at the nail salon on this day? Because I know I was there. I counted a total of 10 customers for the day. Well, they deposited $75,000 that day. Those are pretty expensive pedicures. So we're building a case like that. And he shows up in this van that he came to the store in to buy this equipment. So I was like, well, maybe he's going to buy something else somewhere else. Maybe he's going. So I called down to the DEA office. I had to go find a payphone. I don't have a cell phone. And then I called the downtown office. I'm up in Roswell at the time. And I said, hey, I'm up here. Daryl's here. He's got the van. Bring me a beeper. Bring me a beeper. Today, we do all this GPS crap. Back then, GPS didn't exist. We didn't have all these satellites. We didn't have all this crap. We had a device that was about the size of this Tupperware thing that had a magnet, a big strong magnet on the thing, and we'd have to stick that on a car somewhere, and then we'd have to follow it within eyesight. And it would, the screen would look like Pac-Man. You'd have all these dots, blah, 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 blah. And you'd follow the, it was like Fred Flintstone technology looking back today. But that was state-of-the-art crap back then. And so I climb under the van, and I'm down in, by now I got a couple guys helping me on surveillance. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to climb under the van. You guys, let me know when he comes out. So I climb under the van. I got my portable radio and I got the magnet thing. And I'm under the van looking for a place. Where am I going to stick it? Am I going to stick it here? And while I'm the next thing I know, I look over and there's 2 feet at the driver's door right next to my head. And of course, the first thing I'm thinking is surveillance guys. What happened to like, he's walking towards you. He keeps coming out of the nails. What the? Nobody gives me a heads up. So I'm thinking, holy, he's going to see me, but he doesn't see. He gets in the van. Now I'm like, okay, I got to stick this somewhere. So I just stick it on, and he backs out of parking space.
And you're still under the
van. And I'm still under the van. And I'm like, oh, my God. So I grab, I hang on to the drive shaft, which spins. I'm hanging on to that, suspending my, pulling myself up like a pull-up on this thing. So when he backs up, it's dragging me backwards. And then when he puts it in drive and takes off, I just let go, and he, like, runs over me. And he goes, and I'm just laying there in the road. If he had looked in the rearview mirror, he'd go, did I just run over this guy? Where did this guy come from? But obviously, he never looked, so he didn't see me.
Oh, my gosh. This is like a movie.
Yeah. Oh, God. We followed this guy to a house in the middle of nowhere, and this was the lab. This was the lab site. And because we had no idea at the time where the lab was, and we didn't know at that moment, although you could tell based on its location, there's a good place to have a lab. And then we used all kinds of state-of-the-art at the time technology, and we got a sneak a peek search warrant so we could break into the house at night, not tell anybody we were there. We could take pictures, we could take samples. We found the lab in the basement. I mean, it was, he had really done a lot to conceal this lab. That property was backed up to the swamp. He had built this very intricate exhaust system where using PVC pipe that he pumped all his waste and all the fumes into the swamp, like 30 yards from the house. So you couldn't, you know, lab smells, you can never get rid of the smell of a, but you couldn't smell it because it, the filtration going through the swamp bubbled it all out. It was actually pretty genius at the time.
But all those chemicals are, that's toxic materials.
Oh, it's all deadly. Yeah, yeah. And that's why we ended up shutting down the storefront, because it was literally a very small, almost like a one bit, take a guest bedroom in your house. That was the size of the store as far as customers could see. But behind, we had the entire footage. We had several hundred, if not a couple thousand square feet. And back there, we had all this evidence from all these other labs we had worked. We would store the chemicals in this warehouse. And it didn't have air conditioning. So in the hot summer in Atlanta, you could hear these drums of ether flexing. Wah, 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 wah. I was like, okay, we're calling it a day today. You'd leave the store. And in my mind, I could just see like a mushroom cloud over Tucker, Georgia as the storefront blew up.
Whatever happened to Daryl?
So we end up, the front office eventually decides we're going to take this guy down. We could look at, once we located the lab and did our work, we could see historically on the days he had cooked. We'd look over certain records and documents, and we could see the electricity usage and water usage and all this stuff. But we couldn't predict when he would cook. So we didn't know, we wouldn't know until 30 days later that he had cooked. And so the front office decided we're going to take him down. So we did. We took him down. And part of the job, my job was in charge of dismantling the lab site, right? So I had the chemist come out from DEA Miami, and we sampled all the crap we were supposed to, and we packaged it all up and got rid of it. And in the meantime, while we did that, the rest of the group, they went to his house, multi-million dollar house, gated community, and we seized it. His house, because he had no income. We seized all his toys, his Mercedes, Rolls Royces, motorcycle. I mean, everything. We seized everything. And And it was funny because while it was pouring rain while we were doing this. It took us 3 days to dismantle the lab. And while we were there, I drove over to the house. The house is like 15 miles away. So I drove over to the house in a pouring rain. And I walk inside and everybody's kind of, because we have to inventory everything because the marshal is going to take, we're seizing everything. So I got to inventory the whole house. And there's one old DEA guy who's getting ready to retire. God bless him. He's sitting on the sofa. Daryl had this massive collection of VHS recordings, all pornography, all pornography. And he had on his wife's nightstand, he must have had $700 worth of toys. So this one DEA guy took it upon himself to review every single VHS tape, just to make sure there's no evidentiary value. So he spent like 3 days sitting on a sofa watching pornography. That's all he did. And I walk in there and he's sitting on the thing smoking a cigarette. And he goes, "Hey, look at this." And I'm like, I don't need to watch what you're watching, Jim. He goes, "No, no, look at the ceiling here. Look at that. There's a water leak. You see that water? There's a water leak coming in from the ceiling. There's a roof problem." I said, "What do you give a shit, Jim? This ain't your retirement plus. This ain't even our house. We're seizing it." "Yeah, but that's going to be the government's problem." And blah, blah, blah. I said, "You know what, Jim? You're right. I never thought you should go find the source of that leak." So Jim decides to go up in the attic. So he finds, however you get up in the attic, he goes up in the attic and it's on the far wall from wherever he is. And it's a sea of blown insulation, just as beautiful as you can imagine. And he starts trying to walk on the joists to get to that side. And of course he falls.
Oh, no.
And you would expect him to fall through the ceiling. Now, thank God he did not do that. But when he fell on a box. And in the box was a receipt for a mini warehouse we knew nothing about. And in that mini warehouse, there were 75 kilos of finished meth.
Wow.
Tell me there's no God. We never would have found that. Who would have ever gone up to the, you'd go up to the attic, you look and you go, "Ain't nobody touching, the insulation is perfect. Ain't nothing up here." We'd see footprints or something. You know what I mean?
But seriously, did they find the cause of the leak?
No, I don't even know.
So how much time did Mr. Smith get?
I want to say he cooperated, right? Because in the federal system, they all do. They all do. So he cooperated. And this is the story he tells us. You ready for this? So it's back in the 70s. He's, I don't know if he was a freshman in Emory University going to medical school. I don't remember what year it was. He's living in this old crack house down by the Atlanta Pen. You know, that area of town. Just horrible. So he's living down there, going to school. And he's got this old Harley Davidson motorcycle that he rode for pleasure, just to ride around. And he's out riding it on I-85, somewhere between Atlanta and, say, Columbus, Georgia. Somewhere down in that area. And he breaks down. And he gets stranded on the side of the interstate. And while he's there, another biker pulls up behind him, offers to help him. Unbeknownst to Daryl, that biker is an outlaw. He's not wearing his colors, but he's a full-fledged member of the Outlaws criminal motorcycle gang. So they talk and talk, and the biker helps Daryl get his bike running again. But before they're finished, as all conversations with complete strangers go, it turned to the manufacture of methamphetamine. But I'm sure this occurs to you daily when you're in line at Walmart. You've got nothing else to do, and you start talking. And the biker was like, "You ever thought, given a thought, to making meth?" And Daryl's like, "No. Why would I do that? You can make some money." So they exchange numbers, and the biker gives Daryl a totally bogus number, and Daryl gives him his real number. And for like the next 9 months, every month, the biker would call Daryl, "Hey, you give any thought to what we talked about? Hey, have you thought about what we talked about? Hey, have you?" And eventually, Daryl, I guess, got tired of eating ramen noodles every day. He decided, well, how hard could it be? So he steals a bunch of crap from Emory University. When he goes back home to his crack house, he makes meth in the basement. And he's like, well, this wasn't that hard. Now, if you remember back in the 70s, P2P, the main precursor for the old method of man, the same method that Walter White used, back then, P2P was not controlled. P2P, I don't think, was controlled until 1985. became a Schedule II controlled substance. Prior to that, it wasn't controlled. You could buy it from chemical companies. So he was buying it. He was getting P2P already made. Once they made it controlled, if you know anything about chemistry, you can make your own P2P. It's just harder, and it adds more steps to it, obviously. But he made it. And if you remember in Breaking Bad, the TV series, Walter had a little companion, Jesse. Well, Daryl had a companion, but it was an older guy who had been a meth cook named Ray. And Daryl and Ray made meth together. And they actually found a chemical company up in New Jersey that sold P2P by the 55-gallon drum, went in one night, cut the fence in the back, and stole drums of P2P. If you remember in Breaking Bad, the TV show, they rob a train, right? They didn't rob the train. They went to New Jersey and stole the drums off the back of the lot. But it looks better if you steal it from the train, you know? So Daryl cooperates, and Daryl says, I tried it. I made meth. So I made a little bit, but once he made it, they set the hook, dude. They set the hook. And eventually it got to the point where Daryl found our beeper that I stuck up under his van. He thought it was the bikers trying to find out where the lab was. He never thought it was DEA. He thought it was the bikers on him. But he had arranged, the way they did business was the bikers would call him like a month ahead of time. And they would say, I need 50 kilos, 100 kilos, whatever it was. I need meth. And they'd give him 30 days. I knew that I had to have 50 kilos by August 10th. So on August 10th, he would drive down to the Trailways bus terminal in downtown Atlanta, get a locker, put the 50 kilos in a duffel bag, put it in the locker, lock the lock, go to the Varsity restaurant, the hot dog joint, right? Sit at a specific table. You can make fun of my accent now.
No, I'm glad you said it correctly.
I southernized it for you. he would sit at a specific table, and he would take the key and put it in a napkin dispenser. He'd go to the bathroom at a specific time, be gone for 3 minutes, come out in the napkin dispenser, different key. He'd go back to the Trailways bus stop, find that locker, open up, duffel bag, cash. Other than that one time on the side of the interstate, Daryl never met another human being.
No kidding.
Yep. All dead drops. All dead drops.
It made millions and millions of dollars.
Millions. Millions. So he gets sentenced. I think he got 15 years at the time. And he's cooperating.
Oh, that's after a reduction. Okay.
I think he got 15 years. He goes off to prison to get sent down to some minimum security joint in Florida. I can't remember where he got sent. While he's down there, he escapes from federal prison, right? It's minimum security, so he's like assigned, I don't know, garden duty or whatever, and jumps a fence. They don't miss him until head count at the end of the day. He's gone. Comes back to Atlanta, beats an attorney nearly to death with a shovel and shoots him. I think 5 times shoots him. But the attorney doesn't die. Evil never dies. The attorney doesn't die. Now, Daryl will tell you later. Daryl will say later, the guy owed me some money. I believe the guy was hiding money for Daryl in some of these areas when he was making all these millions and hid it and kept it hidden for Daryl. And then when Daryl was like, okay, I need some money from my commissary. I need to buy some Twinkies or whatever, called a deposit. The guy wouldn't take his calls, wouldn't answer, wouldn't give him any of the money back. So Daryl went there to get his money. And barely kill. So now he's an escaped federal fugitive who nearly kills a lawyer. Now the U.S. Marshals are after him. And I guess maybe 7 to 8 months after that, the Marshals catch him in Tennessee. They catch him. So he goes back to serve out his sentence with us, and he gets an additional 10 years on top of it. And now he's working in North Carolina, still in the medical field, but not as a practicing physician. Right, because he never lost his medical license because he never practiced medicine.
Wow. The things that it is.
You can't make this up. So he turned into Heisenberg when he went back and killed and tried and almost murdered the lawyer. you see this whole transformation of this mild-mannered, meek. He was like almost a child prodigy because he started Emory Medical School at like age 17. He should have been a senior in high school, and he was in medical school. He was a genius, if only he could use his talents for good and not evil.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Steve has tons of cases that he talks about in his book. We obviously don't have time to get into all of them, but let me ask you, Steve, why did you finally decide to retire from DEA when you did?
That's another funny story.
Everything's a funny story.
Everything's a funny story to me. You know, God bless. Life's too short to be serious. So, of course, I stayed in 87, somewhere in that window, DEA changed retirement systems. Right? So we went to the current retirement system that exists, where you deposit money in your 401k and the government matches so much. And that's what you basically have for your retirement, whatever you save and the government matches. But I'm part of your old retirement system where you didn't pay into Social Security, paid into the government pension system. And then I thought, well, here I am. I'm like 50, I'm 49 years old. I probably should have done this when I was 29, but of course, who thinks of this? I went to a retirement seminar, 49, and I'm the only one, and it's up in Quantico. So I go to Quantico to attend that retirement seminar. While I'm there, I find out I'm the only one in my class who's under the old retirement system. Everybody's under the current system. So they're all learning. We spend, I think, 3 days of instruction. First 2 days is all about the new system. It means nothing to me. I'm just bored, stupid, twiddling my thumbs. What a waste of my life. On the third day, the instructor says, if you're under the old system, tomorrow is just for you. You come in tomorrow. I'm the only one there. So everybody else goes and I don't know what the hell they did. Goof off, play golf. I don't know where they went, but they weren't in class. And I'm the only guy in class on the day three. Well, I brought all my pay stubs with me. So when she's going over scenarios, I'm pulling out my pay stubs and I'm plugging in my numbers to her scenarios. And then I'm like, can you double check this? Is this right? So she looks, she goes, yeah, that's all right. And I found out that once I turned 50, because under the old system, you can't go out before 50, right? We're mandatory to retire 57, but I can't go out under the old system before 50. I find out when I turn 50, I would literally, after all the changes, I would be bringing home $100 a month less than if I stayed working. So if I stayed working after age 50, I'm making $100 a month. I don't need to. Why do I want to stay with DEA and all the crap for $100? I can welcome to Walmart for $100. I could do something else. So I put in my pay. As soon as I returned from the seminar, I put in my retirement papers. I said, effective August 23rd or whatever it was, whatever the end of that pay period was, my birthday. Because that August, I turned 50, 9 months later, 10 months later.
Wow. All right. Well, and just so everybody knows, I mean, we've done talking a lot of funny stories here, but a lot of seriousness went on in his career. Steve is the recipient of two DEA Administrators Awards, which for us, that's the highest you can get within the agency. He received 15 exceptional service awards.
Because I'm not that exceptional.
He received over 65 awards from state, local, and other federal agencies. And on top of that, he received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Drug Enforcement Officers Association. So the man has done, I mean, he's telling us a lot of funny stories and it is hilarious. His book is hilarious, but there's a lot of seriousness went on in there.
And if you don't know me, those all stats sound very impressive.
When I was telling him about this before I hit record today, he's like, I don't know what they are. Well, hey, Mercer Train Criminal Investigator, I can find stuff like that.
Yeah, you did. Because I don't know what the hell it for.
So after retirement, you run the Speakers Bureau. You actually hired Javier several times to come in and speak to classes. Thank you very much. Always had a good time with those. What was the Louisiana trooper's name?
Bobby Smith. Bobby Smith. God bless.
Oh, yeah. Love that
guy. Bless his heart. Yeah. Rest in peace, Bobby. He's gone.
But one of the things that you got involved with, we've all heard of the Alex Murdaugh murder case down in South Carolina that went on. It's back in the news again. They're ordering a new trial. Looks like there's going to be a whole new trial because of jury tampering or whatever the accusations are. Okay. But if you remember, there was a separate murder victim that could be or could not be associated with the Murdaugh case, a guy named Stephen Smith.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory Lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.
And how in the world did you get involved in that investigation?
Everything happens for a reason, right? When COVID hit, I call it the zombie apocalypse. When the apocalypse hit, I was an instructor for the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, FLETC, here in Charleston. They have several campuses. The biggest one is in South Georgia, where back in the 80s, DEA used as their academy. Of course, now we're up in Quantico with our sisters at the Bureau, but back then we were at FLETC. Well, they have a FLETC here in Charleston. They have one in New Mexico. They have a small one up in Maryland. So there's a couple campuses. Hell, I didn't even know they had one in Charleston, to be honest with you. And they contacted me and hired me in 2015 to be an instructor. And I taught for them for like 6 or 7 years when the apocalypse hit. Well, when the apocalypse hit, there was no face-to-face training anymore for like 2 years. I was a firearms instructor and a tactical instructor and a shooting instructor, a driving instructor. You can't do all that virtually. Everybody go like this. Okay, see how you do? I mean, doesn't work. So I was like, well, what am I going to do? Damn, I just had bought my current house and I was renovating, which is a horrible time to do renovations during the apocalypse because now sheets of plywood are going for like $300 a sheet.
Yeah, that's ridiculous.
It's costing me a fortune to fix my house. So I'm like, what am I going to do? So I did something I thought I would never do. I reached out to a bunch of defense attorneys and said, you guys need help. I can locate witnesses. I can do stuff. I made some calls to defense attorneys I knew in Charlotte and Asheville, and they gave me leads here in Charleston. So I interviewed with all them and I got the same answers from all of them. We're not trying anybody. There's no cases going on. We're not going to court. There's no juries. Everybody is, it's the apocalypse. We're not doing it. But once we get started, we'll have more work, but we don't have anything at this moment. Okay. And then on Father's Day, I get a phone call and a guy goes, hey, I got a client just locked up for attempted murder. You ready for a challenge? And I was like, who is this? Who are you?
Bachman, is that you?
Yeah. I'm like, stop kidding. At least you could pretend to be somebody important. And it was actually one of the top criminal defense attorneys in Charleston called me. And so I said, yeah, so Father's Day, I'm out at a crime scene, and I'm doing some work, and I'm working for this attorney. And long story short, he took a liking to me, and he liked the way I did things, and he liked how I interviewed people and the results I got and the reports I prepared. So he calls me into his office right at, I would say, 2 weeks after Alec Murtaugh murdered his wife and son. He wasn't a suspect at the time, or if he was, nobody knew. He hadn't been arrested for it. But right after the murder of his son and his wife and son, 2 weeks after that, Andy calls me in, and he says, "Hey, what do you know about the Murtaughs? And I was like, who are they? I don't know nothing about them. He goes, they're this iconic family down in this part of the state. Their family has been the, here in South Carolina, we don't call them DAs, district attorney, we call them solicitors. So their family's been the solicitor in that county since 1908 or something. And their daddy and granddaddy and all this crap and blah, 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 blah. And I said, never heard of him. I don't know. He goes, perfect. You're the perfect guy. You're not going to be blindsided by any of this crap. You don't owe anybody anything. You don't need favors from anybody. You are totally objective. He goes, we've been hired. Our firm has been hired to represent this kid named Stephen Smith. Stephen's a 19-year-old college student who was found dead in the middle of the road in these back roads in the same county where the Murtaugs lived. And rumor has it the Murtaugs had him murdered. Rumor has it, well, the Stephen Smith was openly gay, but the rumor was he was having an affair with one of Murtaugh's two sons, the one that's not dead, the one that's still alive. He goes, all rumors, don't know what's true, what's not. I need you to find out who killed Stephen Smith. Now, when I got that phone call, Stephen had already been dead 5 years, 7 years. It was already an old case, a cold case. It wasn't recent. It was 5 or 7 years ago. So I started looking into it. And in addition, Stephen was mysterious because they never solved who killed him. Then they also had, in addition to that, they had a housekeeper. The Murtaugs had a housekeeper who died mysteriously, right? And then there was, I can't remember, there was another one. Somebody, oh, and then the son who was shot and murdered by Alec Murtaugh, by the dad, the son had been in a boating accident that killed this innocent girl. The girl's family sued the Murtaugh family for her death civilly, asking for millions. And as part of that lawsuit, they started looking into his financial holdings, and that opened a massive can of worms that nobody expected and took the case in all these different directions. But I get hired to find out who killed Stephen. Already a 5 or 7 year old cold case. So I went down and did that.
Wow. Did you solve it?
I did.
What's the status of the case now?
Well, I was called to a state grand jury up in Columbia, South Carolina. I testified before the state grand jury on my findings, on my opinions. Now, these are all my opinions because now it's probably 10 or 12 years cold case. There's no physical evidence to prove my theories. I personally interviewed those people involved. I spoke to them. I asked them questions. I looked them in the eyes when I was talking to them. When you look somebody in the eye and you ask the right questions, you know if the answer you're getting is true or not based on their responses. Now, that's all subjective. It's totally subjective. But based on my experience, I said, these are the guys that killed Stephen. They are not the Murtaughs. They're not involved in the Murtaughs. I can find nothing that shows any relationship between Stephen Smith and the Murtaugh son. I can find nothing. I've interviewed, God bless, dozens and dozens of people. I can find no proof. It's all rumors. It's all rumors. Small town rumors. And small town rumors, if repeated enough, become fact.
So was anybody ever charged with Stephen Smith's murder?
Not yet. And in my opinion, will anyone ever be charged? Oh, there are two people involved. If one of them rolls, the other will be charged. Both of them have got records. Both of them have been in and out of trouble with the law. Just a matter of time before one of the two gets involved in trouble again and needs an ace and a hole to get out of it.
Wow. And I know SLED investigated that case, South Carolina State Law Enforcement Division, right?
Yeah. Well, this was the JonBenet Ramsey case of the East Coast. It was totally mishandled. It was no agency wanted to touch it. It was passed off from, and every time it was passed off, evidence got lost. Evidence was misplaced. I mean, it is a totally screwed up, horribly run investigation.
Got it.
Horribly run.
Is this mentioned in your books that's coming out?
It is. I go into a lot more detail than we've just discussed. Yeah.
Very good. And I know in the manuscript you sent me, months ago. I don't remember reading about that intercept. It must have been an addition after that.
It might have been. I wrote a couple more chapters after I sent you the draft. You're going to have to read it again.
Absolutely. I have to buy the book, which I will.
Buy the book.
We've got a section that we started here several months ago called Rapid Fire, and shout out to Rick Jacobson, who is an avid supporter of the show, both on here on the regular show as well as the Patreon channel. I have a section every month on the Patreon channel, Steve. It's called Q&A. But Rick always sends me in questions, but he also adds a rapid fire section, which is kind of fun. So I've incorporated that into the regular show here. So these are short answers. If you want to expound on it, it's up to you.
Yes. Is that short enough answer?
That's a very good answer. First up, coffee, energy drinks, or beer?
Ooh, coffee.
Best agent you ever worked with?
I have had the pleasure, the honor of working with some great agents over the time, each for different reasons. I would consider you one of the greatest agents I've ever worked with. And I didn't even know who you were at the time. I didn't know your contributions to narcotic law enforcement. Gene Bachman was one of the best agents ever. Terry Mathewson, who ran the storefront in Atlanta back when I got her. I've learned so much from Terry. I mean, tremendous respect for Terry. Over the years, there have been a lot of them. And for me to mention them, it does a disservice to those I don't mention. So it's kind of unfair.
So that's your answer?
Yeah.
Wow. That's not what I expected.
Yeah, I mean, I worked with two great supervisors. I told you yesterday who they were. But I don't know. I could give you a list, but it's not fair. I've learned a lot of important things, small things from everybody. I try to steal as much as I can from everybody else and then claim it's all mine.
There you go. Plagiarism.
Yeah.
All right. Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
Most memorable arrest?
Most memorable arrest. Hmm. Again, I guess it depends on the reasons. Probably one of my most memorable arrests was being involved with like a 4-ton seizure down in Miami, 4,000 kilos. I did the primary undercover on that. And of course, everybody in Atlanta thought I was just trying to scam a trip to the Bahamas to meet the Medellin cartel people. And it turns out they delivered thousands of kilos. But since the delivery took place in Miami, Miami got all the credit and all the accolades and all the, and Atlanta didn't even get, I don't even think they got a mention. I think they got a mention in the teletype, and that was it.
How about your favorite movie?
Oh, God, again. Again, there's so many to choose from. I have this habit of watching the same movies over and over and over again because I just love them. One of the best ones. One of the ones I love the most, believe it or not, is Tropic Thunder. Where Robert Downey Jr. plays a black guy in the Vietnam War, and it's a spoof, obviously, but it is great. It is funny. Ben Stiller is in it. Robert Downey Jr. is in it, and it's a comedy. I think it's hysterical. I think it's one of the best made. I'm a simple man. What can I say?
What's your favorite DEA weapon?
Ooh, my favorite DEA weapon was the Beretta 9mm that I carried for a number of years.
Really? That's a big gun.
Yeah, well, when I went through the academy, they issued us revolvers.
Yeah, me too.
And then I got this big Smith & Wesson giant club. And I thought, how am I going to hide this? So as soon as I got out, the first gun I ever bought in my life was right after I got out of the academy. I bought a Walther PPK. What are the chances I have it on my desk?
Do we want to know why you have it on your desk?
Well, I just took it off. I was somewhere earlier. I carry a gun everywhere I go. That's the one I carry everywhere. I thought it is the reason I bought a Walther PPK. If it's good enough for James Bond, it's good enough for me.
Good enough for Batman.
Can you imagine the logic behind that? It's good enough for a TV character. It's good enough for me. So I carried my Walther until, and it was so funny, because we were out doing these raids in Atlanta, and we were doing this big heroin roundup, all these morons, and I got my Walther, and we were going, and the guy I'm with is a guy who was like 1 foot in the retirement grave and the other foot on a banana peel, And he's driving around, and we're locking these people up. And we got one more guy to find. It's getting late. He wants to go home and go to bed. I'm going to stay out with some other guys. We're going to go look for – all we had was an alias. His name was Onion Head. We got an arrest warrant for Onion Head. Never forget. So we're going to go into this really horrible, dangerous part of Atlanta looking for Onion Head. And the guy I'm with says, don't bring that stupid pussy gun. Take this, a real gun. He gives me his 45. Take this gun with you. You're going to go out and arrest Onion Head. You need a real gun. And they'll laugh at you. You pull out that Walther BB gun. I don't know anything about a 45. I don't know that it's single action. I don't know what a single action means. Right? So we go out and look for Onion Head. Can't find Onion Head. So I come home at the end of the night. It's like 3 a.m. I take my guns off, put them on a nightstand, take the magazine out like I always did. I had a little ritual that I used to go through. The next morning, my wife, she goes off to work. It's just me and my dog, Astro. Astro and I are home alone. I put the magazine back on my Walther. I chamber around. I flip the safety on, put it in my holster, take the Ron's 45, put the magazine, rack one in the chamber, go to drop the safety. Ain't no safety on a 45. Bam! Gun goes off, goes through my armoire, tears up a bunch of... it goes through the side of my house. I can look, and I can see sunlight coming in from the wall. I'm like, mother, oh, my God. And so I'm looking through the hole in my wall, and I can see my neighbor's above-ground pool. Oh, I can just see water peeing out the side where there's 45 rounds. Thank God it didn't pierce the pool. It didn't make it out there. But I got to patch up the wall so my wife doesn't see. I gave Ron back his gun the next day. He never questioned or noticed that it was missing one round. I never reported to anybody. Astro, God bless him. Bless him. He was deaf from that day forward. He couldn't hear anything.
Oh, but I tell you what, my jaws are starting to hurt from laughing so much here.
Okay. But then Ray gets shot. And I want the biggest gun I can carry now. All right. So I ordered, Sig Sauer just came out with gun. We were getting some gun. So I got a Sig Sauer P226. It holds, when extended magazine, holds like 17 rounds. I was like, that's what I want. But I wrote a letter to Sig when I bought it from him. And I said, I heard you misengraved some of the barrels because the barrels are engraved with Tyson's Corner, Virginia, which is where the gun is either imported or assembled in Tyson Corner, Virginia. The first 100 guns they sold said License Corner with an L. So I wrote a letter. Can I get one? I got one of the missing gray barrels on the SIGs.
Really?
But I used it my whole life. I put thousands of rounds through it, so it's not like a collector's item anymore. But then Beretta, the DEA got like 50 Berettas agency-wide. And the guy who was the firearms instructor for the Atlanta division at the time, I had some dirt on him. He had done some stupid that I knew about. And I said, if you give me one of those Berettas.
I'll forget everything.
And miraculously, I got one. And I kept it until they made me give it up. Remember, we all converted. We had to have only 40 calibers or something at the time. And so they made me get, oh, you had to take that Beretta from me kicking and screaming. I loved that Beretta. Loved it. So that's my favorite DEA gun was my Beretta. Long answer, wasn't it? That wasn't a quick answer.
That's all right. This is your story, man. You think you'll ever put on the Batman suit again?
I don't have it. Two and a half years after I retired, I had a house fire. And my house caught fire while we were at the mall picking up school uniforms for my kids. By the time I got home, thank God, the fire department had reacted. I had an alarm system in my house, saved my house. But I lost half of the first floor of my house from the house fire. And the suit was in a secret closet we had behind the hall closet. Now we had a secret door in the hall closet that led to this. And the suit was there. And it just melted. It's all rubber. And so I lost the suit.
Oh.
Secretly, my current wife was very happy. She's like, she wouldn't let me put it on because it didn't fit the same way anymore.
Imagine that. If you could pick one person to have dinner with, who would that be?
Of anyone in the world?
Anyone. Of any time period.
Oh, I have to give that some thought, because that's off the top of my head. If I could have dinner with any one person. Man, that's a great question, Steve. Give me a minute to think on that while you ask some other stuff.
What's one thing you would tell a rookie DEA agent now?
Find another job. I've raised three daughters. My oldest daughter, unbeknownst to me, while I was here in Charleston. No, I still had to be in Charlotte. She applied to be a diversion investigator with DEA, and I didn't know. And she went to Greensboro to have her interview. And she didn't want anybody to know. She didn't want me to know she was applying. She didn't want anyone else to know who I was. She got to Greensboro and had the interview. And somebody on the interview panel, I don't even know who interviewed her, said, Chelsea Peterson. Peterson, are you related to Steve Peterson? And she hung her head. And I was like, hung your head? You should be proud. She goes, she said, yeah. I said, I'm his daughter. Steve Peterson's my dad. And she goes, the whole thing was like, you're Batman's daughter? You're Batman's kid? Oh, my God, you're Batgirl. And she goes, the interview ended. She goes, they offered me the job, but the interview was over right then. And she decided not to take it. She became an accountant, and she's doing quite well for herself now. But when I found out, I was like, why didn't you tell me? She goes, because if I got the job, I wanted it to be on my abilities, not on your name. She goes, I found out that that's not possible. And I said, well, I'm kind of glad she didn't get it. This is not the culture that I would want my daughters involved in. I know I'm being sexist.
No, you're being a dad. That's okay.
Yeah, this is not something I want my daughters to do. If I had a son and he wanted to do it, I'd be proud of him. But I'd also tell him, big saying within DEA is DEA eats their young. And we do. We do. We don't take care of each other the way we should. As much as I hate the FBI, and I hate the FBI, I know there are some hardworking FBI guys, but I'll be damned if I ever met one. I mean, I just have no respect for them at all. One thing they do great is they take care of each other. They look out for each other. DEA does not do that. We can't wait to get ahead so we can put somebody else down. And that's just a horrible. But that's a fact. When I started a speakers bureau, to me, the most important thing was bring in DEA guys and promote them. DEA guys don't do that with other DEA guys. They're afraid you'll show them up and they'll lose their job over. I don't know what the complete logic is behind, but I hate that. So new DEA guy, I would say, get a job with the FBI. If you're really that focused on federal law enforcement, don't come to DEA. As good as DEA has been to me, and they've been good, I know that I have been better to them than they have been to me. And I'm sorry that I even have to say that. It's embarrassing for me to acknowledge that. And again, it's totally subjective, but
I'm still a pretty proponent of DEA.
Yeah.
Everybody's entitled to their own opinions.
I'll always be pro DEA, but I hate where we're going.
Well, there does seem to be some change going on now where it might go back to being the Drug Enforcement Administration. I've been encouraged by what I've seen in headquarters as well as Quantico.
Well, I pray you're right, Murph. I haven't seen it. I haven't stayed up. I couldn't tell you who the administrator is currently. I have no clue. So I don't follow it anymore.
Why did you decide to write the Batman of DEA?
You know, I started writing before I retired.
Really?
I did. And I started writing it, and I never finished it. I wrote 23 chapters and several hundred pages, and it just sat there. Number one, I thought, who'd want to read this? Who would want to read this? And I watched a good friend of mine, Tim Sellers, whom I love, write a book and publish his own memoirs. It's called The Last Cowboy. It's a great book. Great book. And he encouraged me to write it. He said, leave it for something for your kids to read and your grandkids so they know who you are and what you did and that kind of thing. And then a couple of years ago, when I went to a conference as a speaker, I went to the Federal Probation and Parole Office or Pretrial Services Officers Conference, which I'm going back to the end of this week, flying out to California. But when I went to them a couple of years ago for the first time to speak to them, one of the students or one of the participants in the audience came up to me after my session and said, I've published 4 books. She goes, you need to write a book. Because I mix some of these stories in with whatever I'm teaching. I want to keep it lighthearted. And she sat down. I emailed her all 23 chapters. And I said, well, I've kind of written one. And I sent it all to her. And she didn't change a lot, but she did. She added in a lot more background information. And she did a lot of homework on it. And then she found the publisher who's publishing it. She did all this for me. So she was like, I'll put you on the byline. We agreed to do it together.
And what's the idea what is it you want people to take away from reading your book?
1 minute, just like us today or yesterday, even more so. 1 minute you're laughing and the next minute you're terrified. That's what this job really is. But I'd like to think of it as there's more laughing than there is terror. But the terror is what keeps us back, what brings us back, why we keep going. I always said to have a great, in my eyes, to have a great day, I would put somebody in jail, take away all their and have some laughs. If I accomplished those 3 things, then I had a great day. I had a great day.
I agree with you 100%. That is a good day. So but now what is Steve Peterson doing and what does the future hold for you, brother?
Well, God bless. Who knows? I look at who thought I'd be working on a Murtaugh murder case? Who knew that I would be on Netflix as a result of that? Who knows what the future holds? But if I could write any of it, I would love to stay involved teaching police, stay in law, continuing to teach law enforcement. But also, I think I've got a very strong message specifically about informal leadership and the importance of informal leadership to get out to corporate America. I never became an official supervisor with DEA. I spent my whole 30 years as the most senior street agent in DEA. What does that mean? Absolutely nothing. It just means as a grade 13, which is the highest non-supervisory position you can get, I've been a grade 13 longer than anybody else in DEA at the time of my retirement. And it wasn't because I wasn't capable of. I think in many instances, and that's kind of what I try to teach now, you can have just as much influence on the culture and the agency as a non-supervisor, sometimes more so than a supervisor. And I think oftentimes the wrong type of people get promoted because all they're seeking is the title. They're not seeking the duty.
Yeah, the responsibility.
Yeah, yeah.
I would agree with that. Looking back on your career, what is it that you're most proud of?
I'm most proud of the fact that I was able to give Val Stastny, now Val Diaz, Ray's widow, some closure and hope regarding the murder of her husband, Ray.
Man, that's got goosebumps.
That's what I'm most proud of.
That's just so honorable. That being there for people, it's, oh. You know, and I know we talked a little bit, you mentioned there that we do tend to eat our own. It seems to me like in DEA, we always remember the worst thing about each other, not the best things. But I did see as the career went on, where you get into different positions of responsibility, you can affect change. And having Michelle Linhart as our administrator when she was in, I felt comfortable and maybe bending the rules a little bit to help our personnel that needed help at the time. One agent that I was in Miami with, I was in Columbia with, he worked for Javier at one point. He worked for me back in the Fusion Center, developed cancer, and he was engaged. And the one thing he wanted to do before he died, it was incurable cancer, was he wanted to marry his fiancée. And we held a wedding in the hospital in Baltimore. That involved, statute of limitations run out now and OPR call if you want, but I used some government resources to make things happen. And later on, when all the SACs were in headquarters meeting with the administrator. Towards the end, as she's releasing us all, she said, "Steve, I need you to stay back just a minute. I've got a question for you." And it's never good.
Yeah, no. I know that feeling.
And she said, she asked me questions about that. She said, "Did this really happen?" And just like you, I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to impugn my integrity. I did it, and I admitted to it. And she stood quiet there for about 15 seconds, just staring at me. And I thought, well, I guess I know when I'm retiring. Today, probably. And she looked at everybody else, and she said, "That's the kind of DEA we want now, where we do take care of our own people." And, you know, I want to go give her a hug after that, because
yeah, of course.
It's not that you're trying to gyp the taxpayers out of everything. You're taking care of people who have dedicated their lives to serving the public. You're a public servant. And when you need help, it's okay to step up and help them. So just love that lady to death still to this day.
When Ray was killed, he had a memorial service in Atlanta. And the church, I can't remember the name of the church, was huge. It was standing room only. People were lined up in the street to go. And I gave one of the eulogies at his service. And then we flew his body up to Long Island. He was laid to rest. He was buried in Long Island, where he's from. And the SAC at the time, I accompanied Val. So I flew up with Val Stastny, Ray's widow. And I stayed with her the whole time. And I brought my wife with me as well. And we went up there. But DEA paid for my flight and all that stuff. I paid for my wife's. But then the entire group, now this is before we knew anything about the perjury and their involvement and how the case, the murder and the lying of the, this is before we knew any of that. DEA paid for every agent and every task force officer in that group to fly to Long Island and attend his memorial service, his funeral. And at that time, there was no official way to do that. So he just did it. I mean, he somehow, travel documents were approved. Not sure what all of them said. I only knew what mine said. And somebody in the administrative side of the house in Atlanta called Internal Affairs and reported the SAC for doing this. And Internal Affairs came down and interviewed everybody. Did you travel to the funeral? On what authority? Why did you go? Blah, 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 blah. And the SAC got in big trouble over it. But he did the right thing. There wasn't a way to do it the right way. So he did it the best way he knew how, which was the wrong way. But he did the right thing for the right reason. And he took a beating for it. And it cost him career-wise. I believe it cost him. But like you, he did the right thing for the right reason. And for me, I was like, I will follow you through the gates of hell for that. You're a leader. And we don't have enough of that. And I wrote in my retirement, when the internet came out, and suddenly we all had access to the internet, and we could send emails, and bam, I could send an email to a task force officer in New Jersey if I wanted, and sell them a pair of sneakers that I was, you know what I mean? And the DEA internal email system kind of became almost like eBay to some extent, people getting timeshare. And so before you knew it, DEA had all these regulations regarding sending emails. You couldn't send an email out if it went to more than three people without first line supervisor approval. Or if you send an email out to more than 10 people, you had to have second line approval. And I was just like, oh my God, you give me a gun and I can take a human life, but I can't send a freaking email to New Jersey if I feel the need. So on my retirement day, I sent an email out to DEA worldwide, and I didn't get anybody's approval for any of that. And I wrote on the bottom, because on the bottom of every email, you had to say, this email was approved by whoever approved it, right? The ASAC, the supervisor, what? And I wrote on the bottom of mine, this email has been approved by the Riddler and the Joker, is what I put on my email. And I wrote in the email that I now work for an agency that has managers sitting where leaders once stood. And it breaks my heart. Because we're chasing the leaders away. And I hate, we have so many potential leaders here that we are just stifling when we should be promoting that. And I'm glad you see a change in that, because obviously you were in a lot more positions than I was to be able to witness these changes. I saw it just the other way around. I saw it as us just punishing the good people and promoting these total. And it just breaks my heart. Breaks my heart.
All right. Have you thought of who you would like to have dinner with?
Yes.
Okay. Who you got?
My dad.
Oh.
My dad.
Is that somebody you look up to as a hero?
More than I can ever explain. And I lost him a few years back. And I lost my mom first to dementia, but she still lived for another 10 years with dementia. And that was incredibly difficult for my dad, but he spent every single day, all day, at the facility where my mom was kept, because she couldn't be, she had to stay at a facility. She had to stay at a dementia unit. And my dad was with her every single day, every waking hour of every day for years. And when she finally passed, in many ways, it was a relief. But my dad stayed around for a couple more years. He saw my oldest daughter get married. He never saw my younger two daughters get married. And if I could have dinner with anybody,
that'd be the man.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking forward to going to heaven at some point, because I've got a lot of apologizing to do to my mom and dad for things I put them through. Well, definitely wasn't the best son.
In heaven, they'll probably forgive you by then.
Yeah, let's hope so. Okay, last question, brother.
Yeah.
Steve Peterson, Batman or DEA agent?
Oh, Batman. Why be anybody else? If you can be, I got a t-shirt that says, if you can, always be Batman.
And so would you like to end it with saying, I'm the Batman?
I embrace, at first I hated that nickname. I hated it. And because when I thought of it, I was thinking of my transfer to North Carolina, which was not a pleasant experience for me. And as soon as I got to North Carolina, everybody I met, hey, when are we going to see Batman? I was like, shut up. I put that suit on once and I ended up here. I put it on again. I'll be in Fargo, North Dakota by the end of the day. So let that go. But then I looked around and there was a guy in Atlanta who, on like his third day in Atlanta, earned the nickname Puddinhead.
Oh, well, I know.
Yeah, I know. You know Puddin. And I thought, you got to pick your battles. Puddinhead, Batman. I can live with Batman. Because Batman is not like any other superhero. Batman's just an ordinary guy battling the forces of evil in extraordinary ways. And I mean, I have testified in federal court on the stand to that exact definition, because I only wore a Batman tie in court, only. And more than once I had, and everyone the prosecutors used to give me shit over it. And I would tell the prosecutors, if you question my tie, ask me about it when I'm on the witness stand. And every time, only one prosecutor ever did it. Jill Rose, the U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney in Asheville, who became the U.S. attorney in Charlotte, she would ask me on the witness stand, explain the significance of that tie. And I would look down at the tie, yep, and I would, I think I have every Batman tie they've ever made. And I would look down at the tie and I would go, well, this is Batman. I am Batman. And I would pause, and some of the jurors would laugh, and some of them would go like, oh my God, this guy carries a gun. He should be able to. And I would say, because think about it. Batman's didn't come from another planet with powers and abilities, wasn't bitten by a radioactive spider. Batman's just an average guy battling the forces of evil in extraordinary ways. And given that definition, I am Batman.
There you go.
And I would end it with that.
And that's a great way to end this interview.
I would testify to that all day long.
So everybody, if you want to find out about the Batman of DEA, his book, like I said, you can pre-order it now. I'm looking at the Amazon website, so my pre-order will be going in today. It's available at Barnes & Noble and several other places, but just Google it. It's the Batman of DEA, Crime Fighting Adventures of a Street Agent. You can find him on, let's see here, Facebook and LinkedIn at Steven Peterson. And Steven is S-T-E-V-E-N.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my dad said no P-H because he couldn't spell Steven with a P-H.
That's the way my first name is, P-H.
Yeah, my dad couldn't spell that, so I have a V.
You can also find Steve on Instagram, TikTok, and X at Batman of DEA. Okay. And then his website is nationallawenforcementspeakersbureau.org.
No, .com, or the easier one, NLESB, which is the acronym for National Law Enforcement Speakers Bureau, NLESB.org.
There you go.
That makes it easier than typing in all those letters.
And if you're watching this on YouTube, you're seeing a placard up now showing you where you can find more about Steve. And I mean, support the guy. I'm telling you, I've been wiping tears out of my eyes here for 2 days now during this interview. A lot of funny stories in there, but also some seriousness that goes on. But that's the real life of a DEA agent, and that's what the book's all about. Brother, I can't thank you enough for giving me your time and just bringing back some good memories and sharing these stories, even the bad ones. It's part of our lives.
It is. It is. And I have enjoyed every minute of it with you. I really have. And so thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I am so happy for the success you've had both within DEA, because you're one of the few that deserve these promotions and to go where you went. I can't tell you how many people who retired at the level you retired at who didn't deserve to be there. And you deserved it. And then to see you even succeed even more after retirement makes my heart fill with joy for you. It truly does.
Well, I don't know if I'll be able to get in my little office now with my head getting so big here. Ladies and gentlemen, remember this old saying, if you've got to toot your own horn, it's probably not worth tooting. I don't agree with him, but I do appreciate what he just said.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if you agree or not. It is what it is.
And to all of you folks, thank you so much for continuing to come back for so many years now. We're in our sixth year of Game of Crimes here. It's just fantastic. I know I couldn't do any of it without you, and I don't take any of that lightly. I do appreciate you. Tell your friends, if you listen to this on audio, do me a favor, come over to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar, hit the subscribe button, take a look at Mr. Peterson here, at all the other guests that have been on here, and leave me your comments. I like to read the good comments. I don't like to read the bad ones, but I do read them. So that does it for this week. Like I say every week, I don't understand why you come back, but you know why you come back, because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. That's our Game of Crimes. God bless. I'll see you folks next week.
Ever thought about Botox but worry you'll look, well, overdone? You're not alone. That's exactly why so many people choose Caps. Their approach is all about keeping your expression natural, because Botox shouldn't freeze your face. It should refresh it. At Caps, treatments are performed by licensed nurses known for precise and subtle refined enhancements, all overseen by nationally ranked plastic surgeons. Now's the perfect time to start Botox. Book your first appointment and receive a $50 Caps MedSpa gift card. Schedule today at experiencecaps.com. Caps, where confidence begins.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Victory lane? Yeah, it's even better with Chumba by my side. Race to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Andy and Anna here from your new favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
Yes, we are two of the four hosts of the podcast that stuffs fascinating, amazing, weird, mad facts into your ears on a weekly basis. You got any good facts, Andy?
Yes, how about this one? Anteaters have evolved on 12 separate occasions.
Wow.
Mysterious. Wonderful.
The world really wants them to exist. What about this one? When Ronald Reagan left office, he left a note on the White House lawn for the squirrels, warning them to beware of George Bush's dogs.
So there you go. If you like fascinating facts and much more besides, we are No Such Thing as a Fish.